Welcome to another Vox Talk recorded at the CEPR Annual Symposium in Paris. My name is Tim Phillips. Who should be working and how much would it be optimal for them to work, given the incentives that they have? It's a question that is constantly asked in economics, not least because the available data on who is working and how much work they're doing often seems to contradict our simple assumptions. It's also the topic of a new paper by Jonna Olsen of the Norwegian School of Economics and her co-authors that suggests one way we can make sense of this puzzle. Jonna, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Thank you.
Your question, who should work and how much? The first question from that is, to achieve what? What goal?
To achieve the maximum welfare we can think about. Welfare for everyone in a society. The total sum.
And that relies on people's productivity. How do we work out how productive each person is in society?
Oh, that is a great question. We do what is very often done in the literature, that we say that the wage we observe for a person is a decent proxy for productivity. It's not perfect, but it's the best we can do. And I think it's not entirely off, at least.
And that's how we add things up in the national accounts.
Exactly, exactly.
So the most productive people along this scale are the people that earn the most money. And we know that people value money. How do we explain in economics that people just don't work 24 hours a day?
Because we love leisure as well. We love hanging out with our friends, playing with our kids, go to the soccer game, playing StarCraft, whatever you do in your leisure. We value leisure, and that we have to take into account.
Right. So if you give people a lot of money, it means that their leisure has a high value.
Yeah, exactly. So if you think about this example, if I raise your wage, will you work more or will you work less? Well, that depends, right? So if you have a higher wage, you become richer. If you're rich, you can buy more of anything, including leisure, because we said we like leisure, so it's a normal good. So that is what we call as economists the income effect.
Mm-hmm.
But then if your wage is higher, leisure also becomes more expensive, right? Because what is the price of leisure? Well, it's the opportunity cost that you cannot work. So if a good becomes more expensive, you want to substitute away from it. So that's the substitution effect. So what happens when your wage increases? Do you work more or less? Well, it depends on the strength of these two effects, the income effect and the substitution effect. And which one is stronger? Well, then we have to go to the data and try to figure out.
I can see how this works for individuals and for families, but you're trying to say something about the whole society. Given this trade-off, what is the empirical evidence on who's working how much? Why is this a puzzle that's worth thinking about?
There are a couple of things that are a little bit puzzling out there. So first of all, we have within a country a pretty weak correlation whatsoever between wages and hours. Another way of saying this is that we would assume that some people work more than others. Maybe the high wage people should work more, but they don't. It's pretty flat if you look at hours worked across the productivity gradient. But having said that, there are some systematic differences. And that is when it becomes interesting, I think. If we look at different countries, there is a clear pattern that in rich countries, people with high wages work relatively more. And in poor countries, it's the opposite. There, people with low wages work relatively more. So why is that? And we can also look within a country. We can look in the US over time. There, the pattern has changed over time. So in the 1970s, this correlation was negative. People with low wages worked more. And now, today, it's positive. People with high wages work more. The differences are not that big, but the general pattern is there. So then what we're trying to do in this paper is to make sense of these patterns. How can we explain this? And it's pretty clear that it's backed up both empirically and theoretically, is that as countries grow in terms of GDP, the financial institutions improve. And that gives people better access to insurance. And that is how we try to make sense of these things we see in the data.
And when you say the word insurance in this context, what do you mean by that?
We look at the potential to insure against risk by saving, self-insurance, as we call it in economics. Mm-hmm. But in reality, we can think about many ways of insuring ourselves. We insure ourselves within households, we insure ourselves across families, across people, via government, etc. What we do theoretically is look at self-insurance.
In this paper and in your research, how do you explain the choice of how much to work?
What we do is to first try to figure out how people make their choice how much to work. And that is a function of, as we say, the wage you get, but also if you have an opportunity to insure yourself about risk. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about it, if you have currently a high wage, we said that, okay, there is an income effect and you might be happy and want to buy more leisure, but it's also a substitution effect. But there also, when we think about it over time, an intertemporal substitution going on, right? So we can think about it as if you're currently highly productive, take the opportunity to work and put money in your bank account. And then you can use that money at some future point when you might have had a not so great experience in the labor market. Maybe you're on sick leave, maybe you have another bad productivity shock, as we economists call it. So that is what we are after.
And this can very quickly get quite complex when you're thinking about all the things that factor into the decision to work, how you aggregate that. But in your work, you started with quite a simple model. What can a simple model tell us about determining who works and how much, and perhaps why high productivity people aren't working as much as we might think they are?
Simple models are often extremely useful to nail mechanisms, to understand the core thinking of a bigger quantitative model. You can very often back down to a simple, stylized, static model. The easier, the better. So we do a super easy model. Imagine you go into bed, and then in the morning, you're going to get the productivity shock. So you don't know when you go to bed what your productivity is going to be tomorrow.
I'm going to wake up tomorrow and I might be very productive or I might not.
You don't know.
Okay.
So think about the extreme where there is no access to insurance. In other words, there is nothing you can do when you go to bed. You just know that tomorrow I'm going to wake up and let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. So you wake up in the morning and you see that you're high productive. Let's assume now that the income effect is slightly stronger than the substitution effect, which is what the data tells us, long-run macroeconomic data, cross-sectional macroeconomic data. We know that the income effect is pretty strong. So you are high productive. So you work, but you don't work as much as your neighbor who was unfortunate and got a bad productivity shock, lower productivity, lower wage, has to work a lot to be able to consume as much as he or she wants. So that's what we see, that with no insurance, the high productive people work the least.
This is what we might observe in a low income country where people are doing day work.
Exactly, exactly. That's how we can think about it. So then we can go to the other extreme. What if you have access to perfect insurance?
Right.
So now when you go to bed, you actually buy insurance tickets for every possible outcome tomorrow. You can be high productive, you can be low productive. You insure yourself against this outcome. When you wake up in the morning, if you're high productive, you take the opportunity to work. If you're low productive, not so much work, because then you were unlucky. But you insured yourself against that outcome. So you don't have to work that much if you're low productive. With perfect insurance, we get that the high productive guys work the most. So we have this stark contrast in a setting with perfect insurance versus a setting with no insurance. And that mechanism, as simple as it is in a static model, we can think about it, actually goes through in the bigger quantitative model where we put everything in, we put savings in, you have a bank account where you can put your money, you're going to get the return on those assets, you're going to get productivity shocks every period. The simple mechanism is still at play also in the quantitative model.
When you expand this model, it does become a lot more complicated than what you just explained because you add more to it. You're still observing these same patterns that you can match to the observed data.
Exactly. We play around in this bigger quantitative model that actually captures the salient facts in the labor market about who works most in the cross-section in the US. We play around with the financial market and increase and decrease the sophistication of the financial market. And then we see that this maps very well to the correlation between wages and hours worked that we have observed across countries and over time in the US.
We talk a lot about productivity at the moment, trying to squeeze out an extra 0.5% or 1% of productivity. If high productivity people worked more in your model, how much extra productivity could we squeeze out?
So we do an extreme example in the model. We give people access to this, what we call full insurance.
Right.
That they can perfectly insure themselves against any productivity outcome. And then what we calculate is that the aggregate productivity would raise by 9%.
Right. Literally overnight in the scenario yes, that we've yes. set up. 9%.
Yeah.
We don't have perfect insurance.
No.
So I would assume that with imperfect insurance, but some insurance, you get some of that, but not all.
Exactly. Exactly.
Financial markets and the sophistication of financial markets. We now have an additional insight on their impact into our choice of working hours from your work.
Exactly. With access to insurance, we not only smooth consumption, but we actually increase dispersion of hours and we improve the correlation between hours and productivity.
And as we've mentioned, a process of development is a process of increasing financial sophistication. So although it's highly abstract to talk about perfect insurance, protection is available in the high-income countries where you and I live and not available in developing countries. And that's explaining something about the world.
Exactly. So think about the quest for bankerization in developing countries. Mm-hmm. That is exactly what we're talking about here. The potential to save money in a safe way.
Now, I did mention that models like yours have to abstract from quite a lot of things that are going on in the world. You've put a lot in, but you've had to leave a lot out as well. So what have you abstracted from that might be relevant to our results here?
So I think the two main concerns is that we do not put in frictions in the labor market. So people are not, in practice, able to choose how many hours
That's
they
want
thing. To work.
That's a big thing, yes.
At least not in the short run.
Mm-hmm.
And that is sort of our point. We shouldn't view this as a model to understand business cycles, or we cannot use it to get any insights into short-run movements in the economy. We should think about it as over time, 5 years maybe, 10 years. Then we see that people have changed their working behavior. As I said, we see those trends in the US since the 1970s. We see that my grandparents worked 6 days a week. We don't nowadays. We do change our working behavior, but we cannot do it overnight. So those frictions, I think, one would need to add if one wanted to use the model for short-run analysis. And then we don't have a fully-fledged government with taxes and transfers, which, of course, interplays with the financial markets. So those two omissions I would stress.
In your future work, are you going to try and include those?
I definitely hope so. I want to.
But where we've reached at this point, you did promise at the beginning that we would investigate who should work and how much. Does your work tell us who should work and how much?
It gives a fresh perspective on the question, I think. It helps us understand the mechanisms at play, and it helps us understand why we observe what we observe in the data, at least partly. And I think that is a key step forward. To answer this question, I don't think one paper answers any question fully. But I think we can add insight, and that I think we do.
There is a lot to discover about this. So
yeah.
Good luck in your future work, Jonna.
Thank you.
The paper is called Who Should Work? How Much? It is discussion paper 19437 at CEPR, and the authors are Timo Boppar, Per Krusel, and Jonna Olsen.
Next week on Vox Talks Economics, as employers everywhere summon their staff back to the office, how efficient is working from home?